session number 10613, rule 21.
Major Charles Burden Taylor, Reel 21. Could you just explain for us why you didn't want the Turks to move? Was it fear of them concentrating?
That's generally the idea. We were told that we must ensure that the Turks did not move. We must safeguard their interests as much as we could. But the whole idea was that it was understood that the Turks were going to try, certainly in Western Cyprus anyway, that it appeared that they were going to try and concentrate in the area just west of Nicosia Airport. And this was considered to be quite undesirable for a variety of reasons.
Do you know what they were?
I don't really know what they were, except that when one thinks from subsequent events, it may well have been that with such a concentration of Turks, it may well have been that the Ayokabads may well have just said, right, we've got them all in one place now, we just mail into them. But honestly, I don't know. It was just that we're told that we didn't want them to concentrate. It really meant that the island would be disrupted anyway, because if they moved out of their villages, they were straight away razed to the ground. So that created, if you like, nothing else, a housing problem.
Now, you mentioned that one of your jobs, which we haven't covered yet, you mentioned it earlier, but, was setting up roadblocks. How would you set up and operate a roadblock, and how would you maintain the gap between roads? Because, obviously, a road, it's only an open country, they can just go around you.
Yes, I don't think that's a problem, really, because basically we didn't really establish roadblocks literally blocking. We would have, say, 8 or 10 people, if called it a roadblock patrol, and they would set up in a certain area which they could see all round. In other words, they couldn't be ambushed, and perhaps near a bridge, near a gully, so that this question of going round would be avoided. On the other hand, one might say if it was going to be in a certain area which was fairly open, then keep into that area so that if somebody obviously seeing a roadblock tried to move away, then they could be shot at. But otherwise, it was merely a question of checking people, vehicles, what the vehicles were carrying.
What did you check? You checked a person. Did they have ID?
We checked them against our own mugshots that we had. And that was the main object of the question of trying to stop any movement of Aoka people through the island.
Did you have any success in capturing any Aoka activists?
No. My company didn't, and I can't remember that others did, really. We had various... we were taken out by local police on tip-offs to certain hides, you know, sort of cave mini-tombs, in a way. And I can remember going out on one or two occasions when it really came to nothing. And we would go out in the early morning, so it wasn't a question of being seen from afar approaching. But unfortunately, either the birds were never there or the birds had fled.
What were your rules of engagement, so to speak? When were you allowed to open fire?
Impossible. It's the old, old story. We did have rules, just as they have rules in Ireland now. Basically, you are allowed to take the minimum force in order to ensure the safety of yourself or your troops. Now, you describe minimum force if there are a whole heap of people, you know, rushing at you. It's the old story, really. If you fire, you're wrong. If you don't fire, you're wrong. It's difficult.
Did you have to open fire or order open fire?
When I was ambushed, we went straight off to the right and, frankly, for a while, fired into nothing, just to show that at least we were alert and, you know, active, if you like. Other than that, very little. I don't remember any other occasions when we had to. Because if you were following up the cable from an ambush, an explosion ambush, basically there was no sense afterwards in carrying out any... You know, I had one occasion when I very nearly fired one, this particular... This was the time that we did the operation with the Argyles, and...
this is the village search.
That's right, yep. And everyone was confined to their houses, homes. And we heard over the radio, because once, as you know, we had our own individual Land Rover radio, and I'd heard on the radio that two wives had been shot in Nicosia. Apparently one had been killed and one had been wounded.
British soldiers?
British army wives. And that really sort of got the hackles up. And I thought, my God, if they're now going after families, this is just the end. And I went round a corner with my batman, and there was a woman going to a well, and Speedy was the word to home, get in the house. And I said, Speedy, having just heard this on the radio. And she didn't, and went straight for the well. And I remember thinking to myself that I pulled my Stirling, which I carried a Stirling, and since ever I did that, she about turned bloody quickly and skedaddled into the house. But I remember thinking to myself, I was steady, because I could well have been intimidated by just having heard that they were after women. I could well have shot that bloody woman. But you mustn't get, you know, carried away, really.
So your unit didn't cause any casualties amongst the civilian population, as far as you know?
There was someone not killed, but it's one of those unfortunate things. We had one patrol, and a little firing took place, and an overshot went into a village, and I think slightly wounded a woman, which caused a little bit of concern, because it's not the sort of thing we wanted, nor intended, for that matter. And it was unfortunate that it was well away from the scene of the whatever this fellow was shooting at.
Are there any other stories you remember of patrolling? You mentioned a sergeant off the tape.
Oh, yes. No, that one where one thinks of something that's... You're wary of something which is not quite right. And one of my sergeants was going through a Greek village, the one that's had to be passed by the Turks, you know, on our little escort job. And he was going to examine the sort of local, what do they call it, the local pub, but it's really just a big room. The doors were closed, and a certain number of people were around, but well aware, well away. And they just thought, well, now there's something off. They weren't sort of near the pub, and the doors were closed, and that didn't seem right. And so he moved forward slightly, and then there was a slight eagerness, if you can imagine a thought of eagerness, on the part of the people who were watching, quite well away. And then he changed his mind and said, you know, got somebody to go over and open the door, which they wouldn't. And of course we subsequently found that the door opening had been booby-trapped. And the object of the exercise was to catch a patrol, and boom. He noticed that from the point of view that there was something wrong, something different.
Were there many of these booby-traps?
Not that I can remember. I mean, all the ambushes really, I suppose, booby... Well, no, we didn't set them off ourselves, but they were set off by wire from some distance. One had to watch out for them. I think we were warned about them.
What was the general attitude of the civilian population towards you? I mean, besides the actual EOCA activists, what were
I think deep down a lot of it was tolerance. You see, a hell of a lot of people, in a way it might have been like Nazi Germany, that if you've got these bully boys who are going all around the place, and if the local nearest thing I can say is a pub, they find two people who've just been shot, alleged to be EOCA, what do you call them, you know, giveaways, informers, then if you see this on your doorstep, a And you think, well, my God, what's going to happen to me if I do anything? On the other hand, they didn't seem to resent us going round in the area that I worked in. Mind you, maybe I'm being too canny.
Do you feel that they supported the Aoka cause, even if perhaps they were forced into it?
No, I don't think so. Not generally. There may well have been lots and lots of people who supported the Aoka cause and would help Aoka, but I can't help feeling that quite a number just didn't want to have anything to do with it. They just wanted to be content. Certainly the Turks, all they wanted to do was to live peacefully. But you see, they were a target. They didn't make targets.
You lived in your camps. What sort of recreation would you have? Were you under siege, so to speak, or could you get out anywhere? Or what entertainments were?
Well, actually, there was one almost major operation. We used to have concert parties, answer parties, but that was within the camp. We didn't go down into the village. In fact, once you left the camp, you were on ops, if you like. I mean, you were really on ops inside the camp, if there was a flap. But
so there was nobody taking. There was no way a private could just take the decision or yourself to go for a walk.
Oh no, no, you're barbed wire in. And actually, for that matter, one of the big bollockings I got from the CO, because as far as I was concerned, if you like, the attitude that you couldn't shoot unless somebody shot at you, if you can see what I mean, this question of opening fire and so on, I reckoned, I trusted my chaps, and they never let me down on accidental discharge of rifles. But officially, we used to go out of the camp and be ready for anything. But I reckoned that if we had to be ready for anything and somebody's going to shoot us first, we ought to have one up the spout. Well, that was against orders. But I'm afraid I told my chaps that whenever they went outside the camp, they had to have one up the spout with a safety catch on. And unfortunately, I think somebody must have told the CO or heard about it, and I was hauled up and given a bollocking, and that had to stop. But that is, if you like, when you said sort of siege situation, if we went out of the camp, as far as I was concerned, my lads had to be ready to fire.
So what entertainments did they have within the camp?
Within the camp, yep, that's right. Yes, ENSA.
Were they actually stars come over from England, or were they just local talent, the ENSA sort of?
Oh no, from UK, yep. And also,
what sort of people came across?
The only one I can remember is a local singing fellow, so don't ask me any further questions on that. We did actually arrange the WRAC in the GHQ area at Episcopi, put on some Christmas pantomime associated with the boyos, and we arranged to bring it under an armoured car and escort, and rather funny because, I mean, they're all girls coming along, and it's, I suppose, a bit scary for them. But they put on the show, which was very much enjoyed, and it was rather fascinating because the girls were put up in our camp and were almost under siege guards, and the officers were rather amused because our batman brought them early morning cups of tea, which I don't know whether they got those in their own camps or not, but they felt that they were getting superlative treatment. But yeah, that was very successful. It was a little bit more entertainment.
What else could the men do? Was there
Well, you had naffies. You had, in other words, you had a canteen.
A wet canteen.
Oh yes, yes, yep. Also, as far as I was concerned, I had a link back with Tyne's Television, whereby I would send taped messages and photographs of some of the chaps. Tyne Tees were then running, I think, the Green Howards, which is a northern unit, the Northumberland Fusiliers, and the Durham Light Infantry. All three were overseas, and all three were sending photographs and little messages to families, which they put over on TV. The other thing, this is really apart from being a company commander, I was also responsible for public relations. That's why I had this rep from this journalist from the Middlesbrough. I took charge of all those and took them round.
Yes. What else did you
and, have? Well, another one which was very well received, and it was good fun, and that was tape recording messages from the lads and sending the tapes to the regimental associations in County Durham. And they would tape and then send us a tape, which I could play back in the canteens. It's a good sort of homely touch and links with home. And as far as I was concerned, very good fun doing it.
What about the press side? You've mentioned the journalists from the Middlesbrough Times or whatever it was.
Yes.
What other press did you have to deal with?
We had the local, I think the Chronicle and Journal came out, the Middlesbrough Gazette came out, and there could have been either the Sunderland Echo or the Northern Echo.
And what did you have to do with these journalists when they came out?
Well,
was your brief to show them everything as it was, or was your brief to show them what you want, what the army wanted them to see?
Oh no, there's no question of what can I say, bullshitting them as to anything which was laid on for them. No, my job as company commander, I had my platoons out, and one had to visit those on a regular basis. One might have instructions, etc., whatever you like, although we're in wireless contact. But I would take them around with me and but have a chat with them and say, now look, exactly what sort of aspect you want to cover, and have a chat with them in the mess when they arrived or something like that, have a few drinks, and say, right, well, I'm going out tomorrow up to, and we get a map out and show them what my area is and what the rest of the battalion does and so on, and take them out. And on this occasion we were ambushed on the way back.
Got what sort of aspects were they usually interested in?
Well, very much the human aspect. They wanted to know, I used to try and temper it to cool down the danger side, but at least uphold enough of the manly side that we weren't having a soppy existence, if you like. But we didn't want mums and sweethearts and wives to be sort of horrified the way the press usually booms these things out. And also I'd take them out to the other camp and show them around. They liked this idea of talking to Tommy Dixon. And, so Tommy Dixon of Spennymoor, when I asked him about Ayoka, said so-and-so, so-and-so, so-and-so. And they might talk about the food or some of the things that we're talking about.
So you wouldn't get press from the national newspapers. They'd presumably be dealt with higher up, would they?
I would say that is true, because they would have reps in Nicosia, because that's the sort of things that they wanted. They would get from Nicosia the sort of thing that I was pushing out or being asked to do was really the local side, the more down-to-earth human side. Tommy Jackson and his mum, or Mary Smith and her husband out in Cyprus and other way around, as opposed to the massive operation on so-and-so, so-and-so.
What about sport? Was there much sport in the camp?
Yep, we would play football, any of the sort of housey-housey type things in canteen games were feasible. I think that the odd volleyball was, volleyball you can play anywhere, so that sort of thing, but anything to get a bit of exercise.
Would you still participate? Were you still playing rugger and volleyball?
There was no rugger and I wasn't a footballer, but I don't remember playing any volleyball myself. Nope. We built our own church, as a matter of interest, in one of the camps.
Well, did the men get bored at all in camp? It's rather like being in a prisoner of war camp, in a sense. You're not really allowed out.
Was there a
feeling of having lost your freedom at all?
Oh, I don't think there's any loss of freedom, no. But I think that probably there's a certain amount of boredom. There must have been. I don't record it as being an active thing.
What about the stress thing of being on active, liable to be ambushed or sniped, or not sniped, but shot?
No, same sort of thing.
Did that affect people?
I think that, this is 1989, and I think that nowadays people rather talk too much about the stress of this and the stress of that and the stress of the other. I had nearly 140 chaps, and as far as I'm concerned, I could trust them to put one up the spout and go out and bugger the stress or whatever. We didn't even think about stress, and we just got on with the job and learned by mistakes if we made them, and That was that. So I think there might have been a certain amount of boredom, because I mean, if there's not enough to do, then you can get bored.
Did you see anything of your high command? Your high command?
Oh, yes, yes. We were quite often visited by the civilian side. The high commissioners were down quite a lot.
Who was that?
Michael Foot. Nigel Foot. Michael Foot.
One of the Foots.
One of the Foots, certainly. And he was extremely good. Because he got about... I can't remember the name. General Harding was just before me, I think. But we used to have quite a lot of brass hats that were thereafter. No, they weren't shy about coming around to see us. And we got some rather nice, what can I say, commendation letters after various operations, like the one that we did with the Argyles.
Now, how long exactly were you in Cyprus? Do you have the exact dates that you were there from?
Yes, roughly July 58 to about May 59, we were in Cyprus. But in that time, the AUKA problems had been settled. We like to say, of course, that the DLI, having been sent out, was settled in no time. But having been last in as a unit coming into Cyprus, then, of course, we were the first out. So we were the first to be posted back to UK, and we ended up in Honiton in Devon.
In where?
Honiton, H-O-N-I-T-O-N, or Honiton, Devon. And by this time, I had, in fact, taken over as battalion second in command, because Major Sean Kelly had gone off to, I think, take over, at that time, probably one of the TA battalions.
Now, it's at this time that you did retire in 1960.
Yep.
And retirement must have been coming up in your mind. What were your thoughts about retirement and your future? Whether you should stay in or whatever?
I think actually the main points that crossed my mind, because a couple of years before, we had been all asked, because there was a surfeit of officers apparently at the time, whether we'd like to retire, and there was some redundancy payments and all that sort of jazz. And frankly, I'd written back promptly saying that I didn't want to. So that was that. But then, of course, we were nearly hell-bound to go out to Cyprus, which I liked serving outside the country more so than serving in England. So, really, the thing that started me thinking again was the fact that suddenly, out of the blue, because as second in command, I'd started getting all the family details together, so that when we were put in our sort of basic, wherever we're going to be, if staying in Cyprus, we would have all the points and the values of the accommodation needed for everyone with families, and we could just move them straight away. So one was getting the feeling that everything, and as I said, even my wife would be coming out, and so that was that. And then suddenly, boop, although all the lads cheered when the colonel gave the message, he did it on a group basis, called the whole of the two camps together, and the tent really just about went off, you know, flying up when he said we're going back to UK. But that, I'm afraid, I thought, oh my God, serving in the UK again, because if you broke a tree or left a gate open on an exercise, it had to fill in about 50 different forms. And also the question of, that's another thing, paperwork made me think. At that time we were not very well paid, right across the board, I'm talking about private snooks upwards, and I think the start of the thinking was this question of coming back to UK. And if I'd really thought probably a little deeper, I would have said, oh, to hell with that, well, let's see what happens. And being potentially now eligible for promotion and staff, which I hadn't expected, I should really have stayed in, because my scope would have been wider. And that started it off, and having started it off, I came back with the advance party and the battalion following later. And I just kept thinking about it, and then said, right, I'm going to take it in. And so I was thinking of retiring early, rather than, frankly, what I was going to do when I did retire.
So she'd been in the army since, effectively, full time since September, well, August 1939.
That's right, yeah.
And then you'd been a rep for the SOAP.
Prior to that, yeah. Well, I wasn't a rep, trainee.
Trainee.
That's it, yeah.
What were you... you said you didn't think much, but what did you see yourself as going into it when you did get round to thinking about it?
No clue at all. And that was the big mistake. But I know one of the brother officer who retired early, in effect, he was posted, very lucky, he was posted to a UK posting for whatever the last 2 years of his life was, and he studied the particular job that he reckoned he would be able to do and wanted to do, which was related to personnel, and he got himself a qualification and went straight into, he's a good chap, splendid fellow, and quite rightly went into a jolly good job. I didn't know what the heck I was going in for. The only thing I really did know that I, having been accepted by Thomas Hedley's, I subsequently found that that was almost an open sesame. If you trained with Thomas Hedley's, Procter & Gamble, you must never forget to put that on a CV.
So what job did you go into your career?
Well, I went in actually a selling job, and with a bit of investment, which that was a pity, but that's neither here nor there, into management consultancy, but on the basis of selling the service. And one had to actually follow up either calls or contacts or go, in fact, on cold calling. And that was very, very interesting. I had 3 months, mind you, at Sheffield University when I came out, and how to be a civilian in one easy lesson, which was quite an introduction in a way.
What sort of things were they teaching you?
Economics, which none of us could understand. Sales, factory organisation, production control, all very much on an outline basis. But they took us around factories, and they took us around factories even saying, I will not repeat what I am saying now, but we're taking to this factory to show you what should not be done. And of course you tripped over this and you tripped over that, and others you could eat off the floor. But a lot of it was organisational methods and the economies of running a business.
So you went into management consultancy?
Yeah.
And what then?
That company, apparently I didn't realise it, I wish I'd known it, and that is that you should never ask management consultants to run their own companies. They can run everybody else's, so they say. And this one overexpanded itself because it went international, onto the continent and into Scandinavia, and wasn't pulling in enough money to justify all that. In other words, they didn't consolidate in England first. So that went bust. And then I ran a quick car wash company for, what, about 6 years, which we did everything. I mean, I did the job myself. I had two branches in Newcastle, and we were really running hand washing, hand drying in 5 minutes, but that was a high degree of number of labour, and employing juniors. That I had to pack up because the, which perhaps was lucky, because the cost of labour was going up, and I wouldn't have been able to wash, you know, cars at that rate. But I lost both my leases, so that, and I couldn't get accommodation elsewhere at the price that I could afford the company to pay. So that packed up. I then went into a smashing job for anyone ex-service, and that was administratively responsible for 5 factories on Team Valley Trading Estate, just across the river in Gateshead, which basically was everything except production. Canteens, transport, telephones, you name it. As long as it wasn't production, I wasn't responsible for it. Plus the fact I had to organise the move of the 5 factories into one major factory. That ultimately didn't come off, thank God, because a variety of reasons, mainly the economic climate, which changed. And then finally, because of the downgrade, the economy going down, this company shrunk, and the 5 factories became one. And I had a group services manager. Well, we no longer had a group, so I, like a lot of the others, was redundant.
And that was it?
And that was it. Then I went into fundraising for the PDSA, and they gave me 2 extra years over what they originally said they would employ me to. And now I'm part-time fundraising for the National Children's Home.